Welcome to Rams Talk Podcast. This is Derek Ciapolla, and we're here today speaking with Jim Selecki, the author of The Cleveland Rams, the NFL champs who left too soon, 1936 to 1945. And I gotta be honest, folks, we have no idea how long this conversation is going to last. James is a big historian on this, and you guys know how much we love our history. So, James, right away, what really got you motivated to write this book?
Thanks, Derek. Yeah, you know, it really was my main motivation, and I mentioned this in the preface of the book. In the 1990s, I had been doing quite a bit of travel to St. Louis. And right around that time, we here in Cleveland, I was really raised a Browns fan growing up in Cleveland. And what really struck me at the time is Art Modell was talking about leaving Cleveland. Was then right around that time, of course, the Rams left for St. Louis. And when I was traveling out to St. Louis, I said, "Wow, you guys now have the Rams here." And they said, "Yeah, we're really excited." And I asked them, I said, "Well, you know where they started, right?" And they're like, "Yeah, Los Angeles." I said, no, they started in Cleveland." They said, no, they started in Los Angeles." So that was really kind of the impetus through the years. As I started, before I even wrote the book, we really started to research, I knew three things. That the Rams had started in Cleveland. Bob Waterfield had been their quarterback, married to Jane Russell. They won a championship. They moved to L.A. That was really all I knew. And then a couple years ago, just as the Rams were really starting to be in the news because they might be moving yet again, that's when I thought, wow, this sort of historical, you know, resonance here across 50 years, 60, 70 years, you know. So that was really kind of the motivation there.
And with this work that you put into the book, how much of a, I don't know if residue is the best word for it, but kind of a historical relevance did you find with the Rams in Cleveland still? Is there any still, you know, remembrance at all of the Rams being here?
Shockingly, very, very little. And that was another motivation for me. It was interesting. A couple years ago, I went down to, here in downtown Cleveland, there's a shop called Clee Clothing. And they have, it's really a lot of Cavs gear, a lot of Browns gear, a lot of Indians gear. And my wife and I were kind of rummaging around. I'm like, "Oh, wow, look at this. Here's a Cleveland Spiders t-shirt from 1899 about the team, the all-time worst team in Major League Baseball." I was like, "Oh, wow, here's a Cleveland Bulldogs t-shirt from 1924. And, here's a t-shirt about the Cleveland Pipers, ABL team from 1960, 61. And then, I said, "Is there a, do you have anything on the Cleveland Rams?" I asked the sales clerk, and she said, no, I never heard of it. And that really struck me, that the Rams' history here in Cleveland has been, for the most part, pretty much forgotten. And as I mentioned, I think it was because, in part, how the Rams left. It really struck me how they, there was a newspaper strike that occurred right at that moment. So pretty much just almost deep-sixed any conversation that might have happened. And then also, I think just the Browns immediately coming in. I mentioned in the book about my own father. He was at that game in 1945. He was 10. And it's interesting, his recollections. The Browns, as I mentioned, was almost like a technicolor sort of, you know, like a revelation to him, you know. But the more he's thought back to it, and I've talked now to other people, and the remembrances of the Rams start to come back to them. My dad has a friend who just finished the book. He's in his late 80s. He said, "Wow," he said, this is really bringing back a lot of memories." So I'm kind of hoping that happens as well. There's a little bit of heritage here that people begin to realize that the, you know, NFL football certainly did not start in Cleveland with the Browns in 1946.
Do you think that the history here has been lost on any part due to the team's performance here as well? Or does that have...
Probably, because the perception has been, well, that, you know, the team was terrible. And I think I kind of go out of my way to say it really wasn't all that bad. It was for the effort, for being a startup team, as I mentioned, when they entered the NFL in 1937, Joe F. Carr, the NFL commissioner, drafted their first-round pick, as you know. And they drafted 10th, not first, 10th. So immediately that was very bizarre. And as I mentioned, in 1937, Sammy Baugh could have been their draft pick. If that team had happened today, you know, they would have had that first pick, and they might have had Sammy Baugh. And then also, as I mentioned, given the fact that when you think about how Don Hutson was the superstar receiver at the time, and as we know that, I mean, Don Hutson played for the Packers in precisely the years that the Rams were in Cleveland. Hudson played from 35 to 45. So they had this nemesis in their division that was, I mean, the Rams had almost had no chance. They had to play the Packers and the Bears twice each year. And then, as I also mentioned, they were often on the road. They were, back in those days, not a balanced schedule. So it was frequently, they would play 6-7 games a year.
And one of the things you mentioned was the Giants never visited Cleveland.
No. Isn't that incredible?
That blows my mind that some of these big teams never even came here. Do you believe that the NFL, in a sense, failed the Cleveland Rams?
Yes. Yes, I definitely do. In fact, John Dietrich, who I cite a lot, who is the Cleveland Plain Dealer writer, and I think he's a very credible guy. He covered the Rams their entire existence in Cleveland, 36 to 45. Very much encouraged them. As I look back at columns and things that he wrote, because he would write, there's commentary back then too. I think people don't realize there's a lot of sports commentary, even in the 30s and 40s. He said as much. He said that the NFL had failed the Rams. That back then it was very much, it was kind of a have and have not league. You know, you had the top half, of course, was with the Giants, the Packers, the Bears, and then you had the bottom half, which then was the Steelers, the Rams, the Eagles back then. Mm-hmm. So I think they did. And for whatever reason, I don't know, because it was odd that Cleveland was considered to be such a hot spot for NFL football. There were multiple attempts, as I have in the book, to get NFL football started in Cleveland. And so they knew that that Cleveland would be a good city for football. Yet at the same time, I think the NFL kind of undermined the Rams when they were here.
You mentioned in the book, too, that the Rams made their fair share of mistakes in management, everything ranging from in their final season not scheduling Municipal Stadium and instead playing in a smaller venue. How much responsibility do the Rams have for, essentially what became a failure in Cleveland?
I think they definitely do. I mean, that early ownership as well, and that's a really good point. As I mentioned, what the group of owners who were derisively called the downtown coaches. These guys were, I mean, they're almost like a case study in ownership that meddles in the football side and not on the business side, and we see this to this day. We see the owners who take a step back and hire the football people. I mean, the example I use here at Cleveland is look at the Cavaliers, with Dan Gilbert. Here's a guy who has no pretensions to knowing basketball. He just hires the right guys. So back then, I think you had this cadre of owners, and they all fancy themselves kind of sportsmen. In fact, some of these guys went on to continue to own teams. There's Steve O'Neill had a piece of the Indians in the 50s. Not a single one of them. Of the up to 40 owners at one point by 1940. That's how many guys had a share in the Rams right before they were sold to Daniel Reeves. Not a one of them, other than Buzz Wetzel, who still had a tiny little piece. The founding one of the two founders. Not a one of them ever played a single down in the NFL. Yet they felt compelled then to tell the coaches, Hugo Bezdik in particular. I think I even have it in the book. Mm-hmm. They literally had one of those guys actually sat on the bench with Bezdik and actually called in plays and actually directed substitutions. So to your point, absolutely. There's certainly culpability from the downtown coaches. Yeah.
What about Dan Reeves? The book certainly, I think, is fair to him in terms of his desire to build a winning team, desire to be successful, but it also makes it clear that he could have tried to stay in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Do you feel, like many owners today, Kroenke, for example, takes a lot of heat for the way he moved the Rams to L.A. Do you feel that he deserves heat for moving the team to L.A., or in the end, do you feel like he made the decision that he felt was best for his franchise?
I think he does deserve a bit of heat, and I say this a little hesitantly. I mean, in the course of the book, I actually interviewed his son, Daniel Reeves. His name is, of course, Dan Reeves as well. His wife, his son, great people. And But at the same time, so I hesitated to kind of do that. More than anything, what I feel is that the history of Dan Reese has been, it's been to some extent hagiography. It's been all the positive. Dan Reese had no choice. The Browns were coming in. He had to move the team. Cleveland didn't support the team. The fans didn't turn out. He had no choice. And to me, and there were echoes to some extent with Art Modell in 95 with the Browns, which is, I had no choice. The fact of the matter is he definitely did have a choice. And I don't think Dan Reese ever intended ever to stay in Cleveland, no matter what he said. I mean, as I mentioned in the book, his first move within 24 hours was to make a move to move the Rams to Boston. And the only reason why that was thwarted was that George Preston Marshall had himself just, 4 years earlier, 5 years earlier, had watched a team in Boston, surprisingly enough, not support an NFL team, which is funny to be saying that here now on the eve of another Patriots Super Bowl.
Good gosh.
Yeah. So now we know New England definitely supports the NFL. Did not back in those days. Boston and Cleveland were thought to be two cities that were unique in that, just for whatever reason, they had good, American League baseball teams. They had good college football. That there just wasn't enough interest. But George Preston Marshall kind of thwarted that move to Boston. He said, look, that's why I left Washington. We're certainly not going to sit here 4 years later, 5 years later, and support another team going to die in Boston. So that was really the reason, I think, why Reeves largely stayed. But, the rumor has it that every year he was perpetually attempting to move the team. And ironically, what gave him the final impetus to do it was winning. He finally felt as if he had enough leverage among the owners. That's one thing that Dan Reeves Jr. said when I talked to him. He said, my father was always seen as a bit of a maverick outside the circle of those owners. Those are those old line owners. Mara and Rooney and Hallis and Lambeau. And those guys were the old line. And here's Dan Reeves, much younger, 30, 31, 32 years old, kind of an outsider, never played football. In college anyways, or certainly in the pros, he's kind of a small guy, actually. So, yeah, I think, I think that he probably does deserve, he was going to move that team one way or another, and was looking for any rationale to do it.
With that in mind, and of course, with recent franchise moves in place, and how much responsibility do the fans have? These moves,
that's a really good question, and I think I addressed it near the end of the book. It's a really interesting point. Certainly they have to turn out, but it almost becomes a catch-22, and it's almost like, well, the fans were like, well, we'll support you when you win, and the team is like, well, we'll win when you support us. And I think the Rams are kind of caught back in those days in the 30s and 40s in kind of this perpetual catch-22.
You noted that. The thing that made me curious, though, was, in the end, was there anything that the fans, I want to say could have, but really should have done differently to keep this team in Cleveland? I mean, at that late juncture between, during the war era, the final year, was there anything that could have been done on their end, or was this a done deal for Reeves?
I think he was genuinely trying to win, and it shows, and they actually did, as they say, they actually did better than perhaps is remembered. I mean, they would for a couple seasons there in the early 40s, they would break out to a winning record, and then they would just sink as the season went on for whatever reason. But what could they have done? I mean, in 1937, that was an interesting kind of battle then, and we still see this kind of stuff today. It's like the ownership says, give us exciting football, pass the ball more. They want, and as I mentioned, the Rams had that heritage, I think, even then, for more interesting, more passing game, kind of an exciting offense. But then Hugo Bezdik, which is his old school coach, rightfully said, let's get the run established. Let's just get the basics here. So I think one thing is they certainly could have had a more exciting brand of football. Probably could have marketed it better. I mean, as I mentioned, Mickey McBride came in the early 40s, and this guy would go on, as we know, to launch the Browns to much acclaim. He came in and said, "There's not enough marketing for this team. this is pretty nuts and bolts stuff here. If I owned a team like this, I'd be getting more fans here, you know? So it's interesting to me that Reeves has a perception that he was kind of a great marketer. That might have been true later. I don't know that it was necessarily true when he was see a whole lot of that, you know?
I think it's pretty clear that maybe Reeves' heart, you know, you're saying he was looking to move the team. I don't think his heart was really ever in Cleveland to be willing to do the marketing needed to accomplish those things.
I agree. And I mean, the guy, as I mentioned, you know, I mean, he was hardly ever here. He was a New Yorker, an inveterate New Yorker, from what I understand. He was a New Yorker in every sense of the word. You know, they said even when he moved to L.A., his son told me, he would still wear suits and ties. He was still very much an East Coast guy. You know, the family, when they moved the Rams, the family was like, oh, my God, why are you moving so, you know, this is insanity. Our family's New York. How can you go to L.A.? So, I don't think Dan never even, I don't think even ever related in any sort of way with the Cleveland market. And probably an owner has to do that to some extent. I think it has to be that empathy or that connection with the local market to really sell it, to sell that product. As much as I deride Art Modell, he did have that. He over the course of time, really embedded himself in the Cleveland community, where Reeves never did anything remotely like that. As I mentioned in the book, he would train in, watch the game, train out on the first possible way out.
So, backing up a little bit to the concept of the book, what was the research process you used to get to reach you? I mean, gotta give credit here. This is amazing. For those of you who will read the book, and hopefully many of you who are listening do read the book, James has a large appendix of sources, ranging in so many different directions. What was the research process for you to find all this information on a team that was essentially lost from Cleveland records in many cases?
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, you know, there's a gentleman local here in Cleveland who gives, he has a website called Lost Cleveland, and he gives talks. And among his talks is on the Rams. And he emailed me. He said, I have your book. And he said, being a historian myself, he said, you know, I know how hard it is to find information, how many holes there are, and also the contradictory information. So basically what it is, as I mentioned, I relied heavily on newspapers. I mean, there's really nothing much else you could rely on beyond that. First-hand accounts, there are precious few people still alive from that era. And even then, I was talking with Bob Grease, of course, his father, Robert, was a founding owner. And Bob himself, of course, was a minority owner of the Browns. And I mentioned that as well to him. I said, well, you know, he asked me if I'd interviewed anybody from that era. And I said, well, you know, very few unfortunately are still alive. And he said, well, even then, he said, I wonder honestly how good their memories would be. And I laughed and he said, no, I'm serious. You know, he himself was in his late 80s. So I don't have that ability. Somebody really should have written this book 20 years ago, ideally. You know, it's interesting. Hal Lebovitz wrote that, you know, almost like a landmark sort of story called, you know, Remember the Cleveland Rams or the Plain Dealer in 1980. That should have been when that book was written, really. There's a lot of the people were still around then, and ideally that would have been done then. So to answer your question, just a lot of newspaper research. And the beautiful thing is, I mean, the internet today. I mean, if I had to go back 20, 30 years ago through all those old newspapers, that could have been so painstaking. Just by getting access to the online archives, particularly the Plain Dealer here in Cleveland. The New York Times had a remarkable amount of Rams coverage. The Chicago Tribune had a remarkable amount of Rams coverage back then. Those were really invaluable. LA Times had a lot of stuff on Bob Waterfield. So it's mostly newspaper work, just researching on just books of the era. Again, no definitive book. There was a book called The L.A. Rams in the mid-50s that is still a pretty good source, if you can find it. Pretty hard to find. I was able to photocopy some pages that I think I got from at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. The book is long out of print, but a sports writer at the time in the mid-50s, Bob Oates is his name, recounts some of the early history. So he had just up to that point, because the Rams were, what, about 12 years old at that point when you were, well, 20 years. Close to 20, I guess. So he recounted some of that early part. So, yeah, as I mentioned, a main part, in addition, augmented, of course, by interviews. But the main part was just newspaper accounts and just really deep newspaper accounts. It's amazing how much you could learn from short items. You know, I would try to get not only the game day accounts, but then the accounts during the week, because those would be where the little nuggets would come out, you know, where some of the rumor and innuendo. And so that was, again, newspapers. It's interesting that 50 years from now, someone doing research on this would never be able to use newspapers of today. They probably have no more near the detail that the newspapers then did, you know.
That's interesting, considering what people talk about today.
Right.
Especially in commentary. It's even what my site talks about. With all that in mind, if you can go back and rewrite this book, was there anything you would do differently?
That's a good question. I really felt compelled to tell the whole story from beginning to end. But as you probably see, it really picks up speed around 1941. Mm-hmm. Possibly I might have focused a bit more just on that era, maybe a bit more on just, you know, 41 to 45. Hopefully people find it interesting from 36 up to 41. The information was spotty up to that point. I'll be the first to admit it. You know, writing out obviously a book like this, you're only as good as your material. So sometimes some pieces I really had to kind of piece together. Writing it again, I was glad to have done the full book. I can almost see someone then coming back eventually and even going back and even just the 45 season. You know, you could really, there's so much there just in the 45 season, you know, and there's books out there, of course, of great seasons, you know. But I don't think I would do much. I don't think I would change much. I kind of left everything out on the field, so to speak, you know, with this book. I was really leery of leaving out any interesting details.
With the story you tell, and I want to be very careful not to give away too many spoilers. We always want people to buy and read the book. What were a couple of the most surprising pieces of information that you uncovered when researching this book?
Well, certainly the newspaper strike. I don't know that that's been reported anywhere about the newspaper strike. That was a revelation. And I don't want to make too much of it, but that was a pretty big deal in those days. When newspapers went out, it was in effect there was a news blackout in those days. I have sort of substantiation for that. You know, Joe Horgan confirms that. Media accounts at the time talk about how much people really relied on newspapers. So that was a surprise to me, and it was an incredible revelation when I was going through the press archives. And because that's the other day, I went down to the press archives, Cleveland Press Archives at Cleveland State University. That was also a mother load of information, but much more old school. I had to go through microfilm and even clippings, just literally yellow clippings that are folded up that were in the morgue of the Cleveland Press, you know, and just delicately handling these. So it blew me away when I saw this big gap and newspaper accounts from January 6th to February, whatever it was, February 8th or something. I was like, what happened here? Suddenly, it just everything goes radio silent. I was like, surely there must have been coverage of this team leaving, and there was nothing. So that was a big one to me. And as I mentioned, I think that must have had some effect. You know, if we had here, for instance, if a team were to move, what if when the Rams moved from St. Louis, if TV, suddenly all the TV stations didn't exist? Think of the ramifications that TV was out, so to speak. So that was a bit of a revelation. The innuendo of the Rams moving repeatedly through that whole time, I don't know that was necessarily a revelation, but it was definitely there. You know, I think what you hear a lot is, I've heard the account, well Dan went back to every owner's meeting since 41 asking to move the team. I never really found substantiation for that, you know, that he went back to the owners year after year. He may have. But what was interesting is how just behind the scenes that were things that were going on. But the little commentaries that were made, you know, Chili Walsh, the general manager, a year before the team left, goes out to L.A. and he's out there for 3 weeks, 2 weeks, and comes back. And the media is immediately like, you know, the newspaper men, of course, are even suspicious. This is a year before the Rams move. And they're like, why were you out there? And he said, well, I was looking to set up exhibition games out there. And they said, well, But you guys are already playing an exhibition game the coming year against the Redskins out there. How many exhibition games could this team possibly be playing on the West Coast? And then he said, well, you know, my mother was ill. And, well, so that wasn't the case either. So the media's antenna, even a year before this team moved, was very much wiggling. It was. I think in hindsight, there was a telltale sort of, the path was already being laid for those people who were alert to it. And as I mentioned, a few reporters who were, you know, there was Dietrich was certainly one of them. Bob Yonkers of the Cleveland Press called Reeves, as I mentioned in one of the later chapters, they just flat out asked him, just flat out, are you moving this team? And Dan Reeves said, that, you know, words to the effect, well, I've been hearing those rumors and they're absolutely not true. And it was just days before he announced
it. That seems to be the NFL owner line nowadays with teams moving.
Right.
For most owners anyways. The one question that popped into my head, this was a real deep curiosity. You mentioned Chili Walsh.
Yeah.
And that in 1946 there he...
Yep.
That's his last season with the team. And yeah. Were you ever able to discover, you know, what was going on?
I think he had, from what I can gather, he had run-ins with Reeves. There was, you know, as we saw, Reeves later had sort of mercurial relationships with his football people. They were love-hate relationships. I mean, how many coaches did he go through?
Oh, yeah.
You know, many, many coaches. Just so I think Reeves, you know, when he first got access to the L.A. Coliseum, he immediately, from New York, immediately sends a new contract to Walsh. He's so thrilled, you know. A year later, they're on the outs. And I think Walsh pretty much saw the writing on the wall and so resigned. So it's a good question. I couldn't quite get at that. But one thing I do know is this, is that Reeves also fancied himself something of a player personnel expert. And I think that was probably part of the conflict with Chili Walsh. You know, Chili Walsh was a pretty, as we know, is a pretty good football mind. I mean, as I mentioned, he drafted three future Hall of Famers in 2 years. You know, when you look at Hirsch and you look at Tom Fears, you look at Bob Waterfield, it's about three incredible picks in two drafts. And but I think he must have ran cross swords with Walsh, and Chili Walsh was certainly no shrinking violet himself. You know, and Reeves later, it turned out that, and Dan Reeves' son told me this, is that when Reeves, when he died, before he died, he told his son and the rest of his family, he said, sell this team when I die, because it's not as fun as it used to be. Dan Reeves really enjoyed the player relations. He enjoyed the negotiating of contracts directly with the players. And when the era of the agents came in, that's kind of when he began to lose interest. So I think that was probably the nub of it, is that probably disagreements over draft picks, probably just how to run the team kind of in general. And it's just something that we saw Reeves continue to do for years after that.
One thing also popped to mind, kind of like a what-if scenario. And I know generally it's not the world's best idea to go, what if. But you mentioned in the story, and I'll leave the details of players too for those who read it. You mentioned the story that when the Rams left for L.A., a number of players chose to stay and play for the Browns.
Yeah.
The Browns go on, they win multiple titles in the AFC. They win all the titles in the AFC. Then they go on and win the first. They beat the Rams their first NFL title. Yeah. The Rams go to L.A. They go 6-4-1 their first year there.
Yeah.
If the Rams don't move,
yeah,
what do you think of the odds that they, you know, they actually have a dynasty in their hands, or do you just win one more in Cleveland?
Yeah, and I think they did have a bit of a dynasty, right? I mean, that period from 45 to 55, I think that's the longest sustained period of success for the Rams franchise. You know, they were in three championship games in 10 years. So, yeah, they certainly built a dynasty, and then it just ended up, most of it happened in L.A. I think there's a very distinct possibility that would have happened. You know, they lost Mo Scarry, who jumped to the Browns. He was the team captain. He was the team captain in 45. Great, you know, great lineman. You know, they lost Don Greenwood, you know, who's a great fullback. In fact, he was one of the guys who kind of bowled his way through, you know, for the Rams in their backfield. You know, he was the classic, you know, sort of bulky, you know, solid fullback who complemented Gillette and Gurkey. Mm-hmm. So they lost him. You know, Galen Smith wasn't a bad running back. They lost him. So, I think there's a distinct possibility they could well have built a dynasty in Cleveland. And that's kind of, and hence the, you know, the title, the subtitles of the book. The Rams, you know, the champs who left too soon. Just a little too soon. They were just on the cusp of really winning. And as I mentioned, attendance really began to surge as the season went on. You know, Reeves kind of said otherwise, but it really surged, you know.
On the flip side of that,
yeah.
What if that happens, if the Rams stay in Cleveland, what does that do with the Browns? Because they don't have all that player pool.
Right, right, right. Exactly true. In fact, Paul Brown had been pretty much kind of cautioned away from going after the Rams players. I mean, why wouldn't he? You know, here he is starting a new team. You have this championship NFL team. He would have probably plundered more players if he could have. It was only after the Rams announced that they're moving out to LA that he said, okay, now the gloves are off. You know, as long as they're here in Cleveland, I'm gonna play nice here. But once they announced they're going, he went after those players. So yeah, no doubt about it.
Well, James, thank you very much for taking the time to talk about your book with us. Where do you go from here now? Where do you go? You've written this very well-researched book. And we're going to plug it, you know, again, folks. You can get this book on Amazon. The Cleveland Rams, the NFL Champs Who Left Too Soon, 1936 and 1945. You get it on Kindle. You can get it on paperback. Take a look, fans. But where do you go now?
You know, that's a good question. And nobody's ever written a biography of Bob Waterfield. And that's kind of an open issue that I may pursue here. Jane Russell, of course, she wrote an autobiography 30 years ago. But nobody's ever written a book on Bob Waterfield. And I think, you know, Bob had kind of an interesting life. And it was, I think, is this. It's kind of a sad arc, actually, because as his life went on, as I mentioned, I think he had his greatest season in Cleveland, his first year. He never was fully embraced as much, probably, in L.A. as people might think. I mean, you know, Norm Van Brocklin was more considered, like, you know, much more of a fan favorite in L.A. in the early 50s. But Bob has a really interesting story. He was an incredible talent. So that's kind of an open idea for me. It's kind of the story of Bob and Jane. And in fact, I spent quite a bit of time with Bob Waterfield's son, Buck. And Buck, at one point we were talking, and I interviewed him. He lives in California. And I interviewed him, and he said, you know, at the height of their careers, he said, my parents were the king and queen of L.A. I thought, boy, there's like a title. There's a hook. You know, mm-hmm. There could almost be a movie there even. So I have considered that angle. And the other angle just being, just picking up the Modell thread, like, you know, just basing, just now continuing that thread. So if you were to pick up the Modell thread, you would pretty much have the entire, pretty close the entire history of the NFL in Cleveland. If you really just between the story of the Rams and what preceded them, and then the Browns, and then what has continued on to this day. So that's the other idea I've considered. So kind of toying with those two ideas right now.
All right. Well, you know, again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Derek.
Appreciate you taking the time with us today, and hope I'm interviewing you soon for your next book.
Great. Thank you, Derek.
Thank you.